Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1986 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 20th through the 23rd. We take you to the Salt Lake Sheraton Hotel and Towers, where the program is just now beginning.
I'm proud tonight to be able to introduce Carolyn Pearson. She was born in Salt Lake, of pioneer heritage. She has an MA from BYU. Over the past 20 years or so, she has written 4 books of poetry, which have sold over 250,000 copies. She has written 7 other books, 6 plays for adults and children. In 1984, she won the Bay Area Poets Competition. Last year, the Association for Mormon Letters awarded her for 20 years of continuous contributions, and she currently resides in Walnut Creek, California. We'd like to hear from Carolyn. If she would like to entertain comments after that or questions from the audience, and following those, we will have a benediction given by her brother, Don Wright.
Thank you very much. Thanks for that. A good introduction, Kent. This group will be interested to know that I had an interesting introduction once at the Lion House as the great-granddaughter Eliza R. Snow. She was as pleased as I was to realize that. I thank you for laughing. I traditionally have never been able to speak to a group of people without hearing them laugh first. And because you seem to enjoy that, I think I will tell you my most recent Mormon joke that I adapted a couple of months ago. You know the only acceptable Mormon wine? Oh, can't we move back to Utah? Well, gee, since you like that one, how about this one? Do you know where fat Mormons go when they die? They go to the celestial kingdom. Now, I expect you've heard there's a new policy in the church to make all the little babies high priests so they all sleep through sacrament meeting. Yeah. And the true all-time favorite. You know how you can tell a Mormon wedding? The bride is not pregnant, but the mother of the bride is. I wanted to do that because I'm not going to give you much opportunity for a comic relief this evening. I've been giving this talk for weeks. For weeks, people have been speaking to me, and I haven't even noticed because I've been giving this talk. Last night, I started to say my prayers, and in 10 seconds, I was giving this talk. This morning, I stood for 5 minutes with a contact lens on the tip of this finger giving my talk. So I am really grateful, finally, to be giving the talk so I can move on. I truly am grateful for the opportunity of speaking to this group. I don't know of any group I would rather speak to on this subject. I consider all of you here to be pioneers, and so I feel comfortable with you in stepping onto new frontiers. Your own experience and observations on many things have been very helpful to me, which gives me the courage to believe that perhaps my experience and observations might be helpful also to you. We are, most of us, not used to discussing the phenomenon of homosexuality. We find it generally very distasteful, rather embarrassing. And this unwillingness, I believe, to address it has prevented us from dealing with it in a consistently intelligent fashion. Of course, no one can address this subject without their own history, their own experience and prejudices, their beliefs. And so I would like to state mine at the outset quite openly. Everything in me is weighted in favor of family life, in favor of the bearing and rearing of children, which experience I value enormously. I need philosophically and practically the combination of the male and the female. I need the yin and the yang, each filling their full share of that circle. I need the male and the female principle, each balancing one another. I need the concept of the father and the mother in heaven, balanced and operative in our minds. And so homosexuality does not make sense to me, practically or aesthetically. And yet, like other aspects of the human condition that did not ask my permission, it does exist. The conditions of today, primarily the existence of AIDS, calls our attention more than ever before to this phenomenon, and we find ourselves, whether we like it or not, saying, who are these people? Who are these strange people who are doing these strange things? And of course, we could be a little more comfortable in approaching that if we could easily dismiss these people as foreigners, aliens, strangers. Instead, we must answer that these strange people who are doing these strange things are not just someone over there, but they are ours. They are our sons, our brothers, and once in a while, our husbands. All during the while that I was going through the experience that I did, it never once occurred to me that I would wish to speak publicly on this, to write anything about it. But a few days after Gerald's death, it began to seem inevitable to me, because I saw an opportunity to hopefully do for a lot of other people what I wished there had been someone to do for me 20 years ago. And also believing that we cannot make progress in anything unless we're willing to talk about those things. Whatever is our idea of help, we cannot really help while certain things are unspeakable. And so, even having moved from Utah because I wanted to be more private, I made the decision to invite this massive invasion of privacy because I felt there were some really important things that I could help to accomplish. In the last few days, I have been inundated by people coming up to me and people calling me on the phone in tears of gratitude that finally there is someone who has said out loud some things, that there's someone to speak to who can understand what so many in isolation have been experiencing. I would like at this time to mention also that a couple of the women that I have talked to have decided to form a local support group for families of homosexual people who want to feel that they are not alone. Those of you who would wish to be in touch with this organization that is just barely being formed can write to, and if you have your pens, or if you don't, there's a poster at the back of the hall that will have the same information on it. But you may write to Box 520-785, Salt Lake City, 84152. That's Box 520-785. Address it to people who care. I would like briefly to tell you my story, and then some of the things that I hope together we can accomplish, after which I will be glad to respond to any questions that any of you might have. And I hope that you will feel comfortable, as I do, in receiving this story. There are many here I know who feel personal concern for me, and I should like to tell you that I am all right, and that my good, strong children are all right. I'm grateful for so many here who have been extremely helpful and supportive of me. I think it was probably in high school when I first heard the word homosexuality at the late, great BY High School in Provo. In fact, I remember what must have been at least one of the first times I ever was introduced to the concept. I remember a joke that a friend told in high school. I can even remember who it was that told me this joke. I don't know why, but I remember some jokes. And this one goes like this. The sergeant calls his troops before him and says, count off. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The sergeant says, please, start over again, please. Count off. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Sergeant walks up to the first man. Are you one? Yes, sir, are you one, too? Well, that was the first thing I ever knew about this subject. And after it was explained to me, I'm sure I thought that I knew everything I would ever have to know about this particular subject. I even went through 5 years at Brigham Young University not realizing that about half a dozen of the good male friends that I had there and with whom I have maintained contact over the years were and are homosexual people. I graduated from the Y, taught school for a year at Snow College, traveled for a year, came back, began writing scripts for BYU Motion Pictures, was in one more play at the BYU, The Skin of Our Teeth, during which I fell in love. I think there was no way I could have avoided falling in love with Gerald. He was enthusiastic and charming and ambitious and creative and sensitive and idealistic. I was crazy about Gerald, and Gerald adored me. For 18 years, Gerald loved me as a human being with all his heart, and he loved me as a woman as best he could. At the time of our engagement, he explained to me that homosexual behavior had been something in his past, and he wanted me to know about that. But he was certain that that was all over, and he wanted to marry me. He wanted a family. He wanted to do everything right. I accepted that fully. I had complete confidence in him and in myself and in our marriage. 20 years ago, next month, we were married in the Salt Lake Temple. It was a good marriage. I was quite content, and I knew that Gerald was quite content. One of the numerous very good, unusual things that Gerald did for me was to publish my first book. He and other friends convinced me that I should put together a volume of poetry, which I wanted to do posthumously, but they made me do otherwise. And so one day, Gerald and I got in the car and drove up to the big city to see who in Salt Lake would be first in line to publish this wonderful stuff. And, of course, we were told, forget it. Nobody buys poetry. So I forgot it, but Gerald did not, and announced that he was going to become a publisher. And so, fool that he was, he borrowed $2,000, and before long, 2,000 copies of Beginnings arrived at our door, and we put them under the bed and in the closet in my daddy's garage. And I thought, well, we have our 2-year supply of wedding presents. But we took them the next day up to BYU, where the buyer there said, well, we'll nobody buys poetry, but since you're local, I'll take 4 on consignment. They came in packages of 20, so she agreed to take 20 on consignment, and she put them on display. And most amazingly, people began to pick up the book and buy it. And it turned into a really remarkable adventure for us. And even more than the books that we produced together, we, during those first years, produced 3 wonderful children whom Gerald loved dearly and was deeply involved with. The first year into our marriage, Gerald realized that his homosexual orientation had not changed, and he was thrust into a great deal of personal anguish. He felt that the counsel he had been given on how to take care of that seemed not to address the depth of the condition, and he was truly baffled. 8 years into the marriage, I learned that the problem was still a problem. And of course, there are no words to describe the depth of the devastation and the rejection that I felt. The next 4 years were devoted to trying to solve the problem, trying to decide what to do. Gerald agreed to put away those needs for a period of time, during which time I agreed to learn about this subject of homosexuality. Now, had I been able to hate Gerald, life would have been much simpler. But I was not able to do that. I knew that Gerald was struggling with a very, very painful dilemma. I knew that he was the same person that I had found to be so beautiful, that he was the same person who had encouraged and appreciated my work, the same person who taught Emily to quote Shakespeare at age 3, the same person who had walked across the park night after night to read a book to a young man in our ward who was just coming out of a weeks-long coma, and who had gone to the prison week after week on his MIA assignment to teach people, such as a young man who came up to me this evening to tell me how he remembered the wonderful, inspiring, caring lessons that had sometimes been the only things that kept him going, that Gerald had brought to the men in the prison. And I knew that Gerald was also the same man who had bought a special white candle at Christmas to demonstrate to his children how the light and the love of Christ dispels the darkness. It was not easy to hate Gerald. I never was able to do it. It was really my idea that we move to Northern California, an area that we both liked very much. And I do not believe that had we stayed in Utah, we would have lived happily ever after. geography is not the final determinant of a person's behavior. And as you are all learning, people are dying of AIDS in Utah. But I did feel that whatever we worked out, it could perhaps be better worked out in what would be the safe society of strangers, as it were. That if we ended the marriage, we might have a better chance elsewhere to work out a friendly arrangement in a place that tolerated more diversity than I felt at that time Utah did. I had four generations invested in Utah. I love the state and I love the people, which I still do. But in 1976, we packed the moving van and left. To shorten a long story, 2 years later came the decision to end our marriage. 2 years in which my confidence in my own self and in life seemed to be gone forever. Femaleness, which I had always known, somehow strangely came in second place, seemed now of little value indeed. It seemed even that to all appearances, God and the church and my husband all preferred men. And those were the darkest of days. With the help of a private miracle, I was able to survive, and even to strengthen my belief in femaleness and in its full value both in heaven and on earth. I even wrote this second part to a tiny little verse that I had written 2 years before, a drama in two acts. I dim, I have no doubt if someone blew, I would go out. I did not. I must be brighter than I thought. Well, I learned that I was brighter than I had thought, and I became even strong enough to let Gerald go with love as I had wanted to do. And to be able to structure with him a good ongoing friendship. And Gerald set out on his quest. To me, it was insane. As insane as Don Quixote. To Gerald, it was deeply meaningful. His main goal was to find the lifelong male companion that he so desired. He also desired to be a bridge builder between the homosexual community and the straight community. And he also wanted to be a part of helping to cultivate a spiritual consciousness among homosexual men, many of whom he found had left behind with their religions even their spiritual awareness, and he wanted to be a part of helping many of them reclaim some of that. With these latter two goals, Gerald found a certain amount of success. Particularly, he found success in his activities with the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. They made a national tour in 1981, quite a remarkable tour, playing the largest halls in the country. And Gerald was thrilled to know that they were presenting a better side of homosexual people to the public. There were, incidentally, a number of formerly Mormon men in the chorus. I met one who only the year before had been a bishop. I suppose they were the Tabernacle Choir section of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. Regarding Gerald's main goal, he found less success. There were several relationships that he had high hopes for that disappointed him. He and I were strangely able to talk about these things, to discuss what he was learning, to discuss even how I was feeling, what he was learning, how he was feeling. I'm remembering one conversation in which he was extremely disappointed after a young man that he had cared a lot about had abruptly moved out, not being able to deal with Gerald's spaciness, his meditating, his spiritual studies. And Gerald sat before me bemoaning the fact that it's so difficult to just find a person who is mature and loyal and responsible. And he said, "Oh, Blossom, if I could just find a man like you, I'd be in seventh heaven." In March of 1984, Gerald was diagnosed with AIDS. He had been ill for more than a year, really, but was not able to face the possibility that that's what it might be. I asked him at that time if he might want to come out and stay with us. It seemed to me a reasonable and a right thing to do. The children by that time knew that their father was a homosexual, and they continued to love him as much as before, and he continued to give them a great deal of affection and helpful support. Gerald wanted to maintain his apartment in the city for as long as he could to receive the health benefits that San Francisco offered. San Francisco had quickly mobilized itself wonderfully to take care of this crisis. I felt comfortable in having Gerald still come to our home because the best medical information at that time, which is the best medical information that has continued now, is that AIDS is not an easy disease to catch. During the next 3 months, Gerald went down very rapidly. And toward the end, he was in my home. That last week, which I did not know was to be the last week, but I sent the children elsewhere so that I could be more efficient in organizing what had to be done. And so during that last week, I took care of Gerald with the help of his mother, whom I had sent for. I also had in my life that last week the ward. And I'm pleased to commend to all of your wards or all of anyone's religious congregation the way that my own ward responded in this case. As I sent the information through my good visiting teaching companion, Anne, who is here, to the bishop so they would understand what was happening at my house, we learned that already they had had somehow to face this kind of thing. A young man had moved into our ward. And upon being visited, he explained that he was a homosexual and did not intend to participate. But as a good Mormon bishop is wont to do, the bishop continued to check from time to time on the welfare of this young man, and upon learning that he was in the hospital in Oakland with AIDS, went to visit to see how he could be of help, and then mobilized the elders' quorum to provide transportation back and forth daily for the mother of this young man who would come from Utah. And to my situation, the ward responded wonderfully. I was not surprised, of course, immediately to see my Relief Society president at the door with her home-baked loaf of bread. Well, as immediately as one can when one has to let the bread rise. Or to have my good visiting teacher, Sister Spencer, call and say, "Now, I'm not going to ask you if you need anything. That's not good enough. I want you to go put a piece of paper by the phone right now. And when anything occurs to you, I want you to go write it down and say, 'I'll have Sister Spencer take care of that. And I'm going to call you every morning at 9, and you'll give me the list, and we'll do it.'" And I did, and she did. And my good former bishop, the husband of my present Relief Society president, then appeared out of nowhere to do 4 hours of yard work in the backyard under the hot sun. And, of course, I received the good casseroles and the good notes and the good flowers from all those good Mormon people who were quite baffled, I'm sure, as to know what to do with homosexuality, but knew what to do about need and about pain. And so as they were out there in the backyard doing things and bringing things, and as my good home teacher, who is now my bishop, was in the garage fixing the shelves so I could receive the things from Gerald's apartment, I was in the front room singing lullabies to Gerald, playing Beethoven and Tchaikovsky on the stereo for him, reading his favorite Walt Whitman poems, whom I had forgiven for also being a homosexual. Gerald passed away on July 19th of 1984. I tell this story because there are so many people that I want to speak to. There are so many things that I would like to see happen. As I speak, I have and I will primarily refer to homosexual men because it is they that have the disease and it is they with whom I've had experience, but I surely acknowledge that the homosexual women are surely in the same circumstance as the men in regards to how we need to consider them. So I will speak in masculine terms, which is unlike me, as I am always the one to raise my hand to object to women being excluded. But please understand that I am including them also here. I would like, firstly and especially, to encourage the families and, of course, the friends of homosexual people to make every effort to understand them to understand the phenomenon to the best that we're able. And even after the place where we can understand and move into territory where we do not understand, still to be able to love. I would like, and I'm pleased to know that already I have sparked hundreds of conversations between people who have needed to talk to one another. I would encourage the parents of homosexual people that if there has been alienation, to make a new effort to reestablish those relationships. And I would like to encourage the homosexual children, even while perhaps they feel that they did not do the alienating, but that they were those who were put away, that they also be the ones to give it another chance. I have seen that sometimes, even while families might wish to continue a communication, that it's the homosexual child sometimes who seems not able to do that. And so I would encourage them also to make that effort. I must tell you about a young man in my county in California. He moved into Contra Costa County, and before he had a chance to make friends there, he went down quite rapidly with AIDS. He spoke to the social worker who was assigned to him and expressed a wish to have contact with his family before he died. He, I believe, was from the South. He had been disowned by his family some few years before. The social worker telephoned the young man's father and told him that his son was dying and wanted contact with the family before he died. And the father responded, "As far as I'm concerned, my son died the day he was born," and hung up the telephone. The social worker called the young man's sister, who had been instructed by her father that if she went to visit her brother, she would be disinherited. Nevertheless, the young woman got on the airplane, and while she was in the air, her brother died. I can't tell that story. It's too hard for me. And of course, we're all so sad for the young man. But how sad I am also for the family who has to live years knowing how they hated their son, knowing that he died knowing how they hated him. I don't know how one could live with that. So my main goal is to be of some help, perhaps, in healing some relationships. I would like also to see fewer suicides among gay men, certainly among Mormon gay men, who have decided in desperation that they are of no value. I would hope that they would be able to see that no matter what, they are of value and deserve to live, and to help all of us come to a better place of understanding. I would like to encourage homosexual people to realize that while their sexual feelings are surely a reality, that they are not making it up. That even within that, there are some choices to be made. And that particularly today, when the lifestyle can be so deadly, that numerous options be considered. I am reminded of the position that women were in for many centuries, in which the prevailing thought was that biology is destiny. That if you were born into a female body, your life was mapped out from beginning to end. That is no longer true. And women have a variety of options in their life, which has enriched all of us. And so I would hope that the homosexual person might be able to feel that sexuality is not necessarily destiny, and that not everything about one's life has to be governed by the fact of one's sexuality, which I'm afraid too often seems to be the case. I would like to see fewer ill-advised marriages contracted through the belief that marriage is the cure for the homosexual condition. There are too many of our eager young women that have been sacrificed on the altar of this dubious proposition. But at the same time that I say that, I must also say that for a man who is predominantly of homosexual feeling, who is not young and naive, and who does have some feelings for women, that if he and the woman that he plans to marry are aware together of what they will be facing, and if they together can have a good and helpful, possibly even professional, support system, and if the man is committed to being faithful in that relationship, then I surely can think of worse situations than that kind of a marriage that a man might find himself in. I found myself agreeing with the response of Dear Abby a few weeks ago, which a young woman wrote in saying, "I'm considering marriage to a man who has had significant homosexual experience. Can I expect that he could maintain family life?" Abby responded, "My best experts tell me it is possible that such a man could maintain a family life, but it is unlikely. From what I've observed in our own culture, that would seem also to be the case." I would like also to speak to the homosexual men who are now married, to speak to them as their friend who knows that they are in a very painful dilemma, and to encourage them to make some responsible decisions. I have spent some hours talking to a young woman in Salt Lake City who has the AIDS virus, evidently, from her homosexual husband, who only recently moved out of the home. And she is, of course, for her own self, shattered and filled with rage, and is also very frightened for other women, believing as her doctor believes, as I believe, as do many experts who are looking at the patterns of what's happening in the country, that she may be the first of a number of women in Utah who will find themselves in this incredibly unfair and deadly situation. And so I appeal with all my heart to the homosexual men who are married to look very carefully at what they are doing. And if there are children involved, if there is any amount of satisfaction happening in the family life, that he make a decision to protect those people to whom he has a commitment. And if he can, to honor that marriage, knowing that some sacrifices have to be made somewhere. Nobody can have it all. Everybody must make difficult choices in their lives on any number of things. And in this particular case, a man must make some conscionable decisions. And I would hope he would ask himself, where down the line could he find the most final satisfaction? And then make decisions that would protect that position. It may be that my story will stimulate more questions than it answers, which is fine with me. I think that's the way we make progress. There is only one answer that I really do have, which is that while we're looking for the answers to all of the other things, while we are looking for answers regarding the disease, while we are looking for answers to the condition of homosexuality, that we remember one answer that was given to us a long time ago and that is recorded in the 25th chapter of Matthew, where the Lord tells us, I was a-hungered, and ye gave me meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me. Inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these, ye have done it unto me. Now, the least of these sounds very much like what many people consider the homosexual person. Certainly the homosexual person with AIDS. All during the month of September, I'm going to be gone on a nationwide tour concerning my book. If I were at home, I would, on the third Sunday of the month, be giving my social relations lesson. It's a lesson I have enjoyed very, very much giving for the last 7 years. And I'm sorry not to be able to give this lesson in September, because it's a wonderful lesson. And if I were going to be giving it, the title is Christ-like Leadership. If I would be giving that lesson, I surely would use a quotation in the lesson material from Brother Marion D. Hanks, who said, "The specialty of the Savior is mercy. And he requires that we be specialists in mercy. The readers of Sunstone magazine are not unused to the word paradox. You write about it, respond to it, puzzle out in your mind paradoxes, try to find a way to live with them, to transcend them. A similar word is contradiction, which is a word used by a woman I have spoken to, the mother of a homosexual man, a Mormon mother, who said to me, "I have had to come to live with a contradiction. On the one hand, here is homosexuality, which I do not understand, I do not like, I have always been taught is a very wrong thing. And on the other hand, this is my son, and I love him, and I will not allow anything to destroy our relationship." I suggest that perhaps we can consider the dilemma, shall we say, of homosexuality as a paradox. And I believe that we can find a way to finally live with or transcend, if not solve, that paradox. I have confidence in the Mormon people, whom I know to be good and strong people, and in the Mormon leadership, whom I know to be caring, concerned men, that all of us, in our various positions, can find a way to deal with this paradox, that we can continue to teach and encourage the community and personal standards that we believe in, and at the same time to recognize that there are those among us, many among us, who find it extremely difficult to fit that pattern. And that we can remember that these people are ours, and that they are his, and that they, along with the rest of us, saying in primary, "I am a child of God." We have a heritage from our pioneer ancestors of rising to difficult challenges. And I believe that we can rise to meet this one. That we can do it with love and not with hate. That we can do it with understanding and not with quick judgment. Religion is responding in a variety of ways to the current challenge. There are some religious figures who assure us that AIDS is God's judgment against homosexual people. And they stand perhaps with a little satisfaction on the sidelines watching it happen. That is what I hope we will not do. I believe that the only appropriate way to bring God into this picture is to say, here is a tremendously difficult, painful situation. Now, what is it that God would have me do about it? Only months after Mother Teresa ever heard the word AIDS, she was in New York City opening a hospice for AIDS patients, telling the press, "These men are children of God." As I follow the newspapers, I see recently that in San Francisco, A vacant convent has been turned into a hospice for AIDS patients, formerly dedicated by the Catholic Archbishop there. And 2 weeks ago, I read in our local paper that in Walnut Creek, St. Paul's Episcopal Church is giving over their adult education building to become the first AIDS residence in our county. And the bishop is quoted as saying, "If you are moved by the compassion of Christ to welcome these often despised and painfully afflicted young people in their last days and months on earth, I will be enormously proud of you." Both AIDS and homosexuality are not just a San Francisco problem or a New York problem. They're also a Utah problem. And it's not just a Catholic problem or a Protestant problem. It is also a Mormon problem. Statistics tell us that up to 3 million Americans today may be infected with the AIDS virus, not all of whom will come down with the full-blown syndrome. But many, many will. And unfortunately, Utah will have her full share of these people. In the next few years, and certainly already, but in the future especially, thousands of our families will be touched by the disease. And of course, many, many more than that will continue to be touched by the phenomenon of homosexuality. It is my hope and my belief that we can, institutionally and individually, rise to this challenge as good Christians, as good Latter-day Saints, as good children of our Father and our Mother in heaven, who want, I'm sure, for the family to be united, that we can do all possible to heal and help one another, that we can truly be specialists in mercy, that we can remember, in the words of Matthew Arnold, that my husband Gerald was so fond of quoting, that the same heart beats in every human breast. That finally we can all love one another as Christ has loved us. That all these things we can and will do. I pray in Jesus' name, amen. Thank you very much. I will, if there are questions, be pleased to respond. Surely it is. Did you hear her? It's not just a homosexual problem. She lost her husband to AIDS from his prior use of drugs.
I just wanted to mention that there is some new hope for AIDS. I recently attended a medical convention at the Disneyland Hotel, and there are some new substances by Dr. Hans Nieper, who was the president of the German Cancer Society. And the substances are carnivora, anti-mutagenic substances. And this information can be obtained either in Hanover, Germany, from Dr. Nieper, or at the Keith Brewer Science Library in Richland Center, Wisconsin. And they're having really fantastic success with these new drugs. They're anti-mutagenic substances.
Thank you. Yes. I believe that all of us would have to agree. I'm sorry.
Carolyn,
I will try to remember to repeat the question.
Excuse me. Yes, please come to a mic, those who have questions. Or if it's not possible, if you could repeat the question, Carolyn. Thank you.
She's asking that it's certainly appropriate to use the word problem in discussing AIDS, but why use the word problem in discussing homosexuality? I think that all of us, no matter what our attitude on this, would have to admit that in our society today, in our church certainly, the fact that the homosexual person has a very difficult row to hoe does constitute a problem. There are many ways we could... There are many ways to look at all that, and I understand what you're saying. But even for all of my homosexual friends whom I love very much, there are problems involved with the whole dynamic.
As difficult as it is for any person to remain single, do you believe it is significantly more difficult for a homosexual individual to remain single and essentially live a life of chastity, as it were, or is it equally difficult for a heterosexual person who, for one reason or other, has not found a life's mate? I think that that must be, in my mind anyway, certainly also very difficult. And on the one hand, we do require in the church that person live a life of chastity, and although we would admit that it's very difficult, isn't it? Can't we expect the same person of the same thing of a homosexual individual?
Having only been the one, I would surely empathize it is difficult to be single and to be celibate. I think that the heterosexual person always at least has hope that there will be a possible fulfillment to their wishes. And the homosexual person perhaps has the added difficulty of having chosen the celibate life, knowing that that's not going to have some further fulfillment down the road. There are parallels, I'm sure, and yet also some different kinds of feelings.
You talked about having the church respond on an individual and on an institutional level. I think clearly as Christians, we know what we need to do on an individual level, and you've been an example of that. In your opinion, what would be the appropriate way for the church to respond on an institutional level?
I'm going a great deal out of my way to make sure that I do not tell the brethren how to run the church. It is their business to make the policies, and it is my business and your business, I think, to do all we can to help one another understand and to create more healthy attitudes. I don't really know institutionally what the church might want to do, could be able to do. I don't know if like these churches that I mentioned here, there could be some kind of response of a physical nature of caring like that. I don't know that that would be the appropriate way to respond, or just to make sure that as this happens in every ward, which probably it will in one way or another before we're through with this, that the marvelous mechanism that is set up is put into action, that every possible thing will be done there to help. If some of you have some fine ideas on how institutionally we can respond, I suggest that you write some letters. I have found that letters are read.
I want to thank you for taking the focus off of the moral issue and putting it on a loving issue. I've worked with a lot of AIDS patients. And I found that the fear and the rejection are the hardest things. That's what keeps them sick or triggers their illness or encourages their illness. And love has helped stop. So thanks.
Of course. Thanks to you. Love alone is healing, is it not?
I have a question, but I'd like to precede it by telling you where I'm coming from. I've been in the practice of medicine for 40 years. I have had to deal with many of the homosexual people, especially in my term in the service, when it was my job to interview them and to help undo as much as I could the damage which the service did to them by treating them as criminals. I had hoped that you could bring out a little better to the people tonight something of the intensity and power of this feeling. I do not understand it. I know that it's there. But I know that they look for, in the homosexual relationship, the same kind of satisfactions and permanence. They use the same terms of endearment. Everything that we in heterosexual relationships find and seek. And in medical school, I was taught that in psychiatry that you could divide the basic instinctual drives several ways, but my professor did it into five. The first strongest drive was self-preservation. The second strongest was species race preservation, which included the sex drive. And I think that the people here should understand that the emotions rule the mind most of the time. You expressed the hope that the mind could rule in some of these situations where a homosexual man was married, and that he could intellectually overcome this powerful drive which he had. I don't want anybody to underestimate the power of that drive. I have learned to appreciate it watching my patients. I wonder if you would comment a little more on it.
I understand what you're saying there. I know that it is a very, very powerful thing. I know, furthermore, it is not just a physical thing. I know that it is something that involves the entire personality. I know that. And I know it would be asking a very large thing for a person to put all of that away. Gerald felt he could not. He was of an adventuresome spirit who felt that he had to find out what that was all about. That he had to have, or at least believe he could someday have, the kind of emotional, physical nourishment that in his mind translated only in a male companionship. So I understand what you're saying. My suggestion and my hope for homosexual men who are married is that if they find that they either cannot or will not channel all of that into their relationship, that they very honestly talk this over with their wives, perhaps make a decision to end the marriage, or at least put her in a position where she can protect herself.
Carolyn, thank you for your compassion and your courage. You have obviously spent a lot of time educating yourself. Could you comment perhaps to those in the audience who are going to be leaving here tonight with questions where they might go?
Because there is such a variety of point of view and information on the subject of homosexuality, I think one has just got to begin reading. Certainly reading the kinds of things that are commended from people that you know and trust, and then maybe just to go to the library and start checking out some books. I think some of the more authoritative, at least in the current professional field just now, what's the book called? The Homosexual Matrix. A Trip. That, I believe, is quite a comprehensive one. There was a book that I found not long ago in the library that really interested me. I tried to find a place to buy it, but I couldn't, and I even gave it back to the library. It was called Growing Up Straight, and it was written by a husband-wife team who wanted to present material to help young men grow up straight. But their attitude was so good. They had abandoned all of the myths that prevent us from dealing with things, that I thought, gee, I would like for very conservative people to read this book because it speaks in a way that I think would really help them understand the depth of what we're dealing with here. So if anybody wants to go to your library or mine and find Growing Up Straight, that would be a good one. Now, I know there are many books that you just would not trust because they start out on a premise that maybe is opposite from the premise that you want. But nonetheless, I think if we just begin reading and listening and talking to homosexual people, it's almost impossible to talk to a real, live homosexual person without understanding, hey, this is a little different from what I'd always thought. That's a good place to begin. Well, I wish we had the deacons here to carry these microphones around, Kim. Darn it.
That was nice. I've been sensing something that I just want to express. I find paradox not simply something to be overcome, but the most fruitful place to find new insights, that in a struggle with contradictions that I can begin that I'm forced to find new understandings. And this problem does not strike me directly. Nobody in my family is homosexual. I'm not homosexual. And so the intense suffering of the problem that a lot of people have doesn't hit me. And I'm reacting in a slightly different way, which is that as I see people whom I think of as my brothers and sisters who are experiencing this suffering and are being alienated or we're being pushing them out, there's a kind of possibility here that enthuses me, which is if I were... I'll digress for a second and say for 1 year I had the interesting experience of attending BYU, and when I was there, I wrote a letter to the editor about military training on campus. And I hated it, and there was this tremendous reaction. The editors said they'd never gotten so many responses to a letter to the editor ever in their lives. And what the phenomenon was that I was a Mormon and I was saying these things, and people had to react because I was one of the fold. Okay, and if we are forced to acknowledge that people that we don't understand, people that it's hard for us to relate to and to love, are part of our family, are part of our fold, that there's a possibility that we're going to have a New Testament kind of reaction, okay? That the way of pushing out and the way of judging and the penalties of the Old Testament won't work when these people are part of our family. And we'll begin to realize that Christ lived with and loved and preferred to be with a lot of the time publicans who were the outcasts and the downtrodden and the despised of the Jews. And I hope, I realize that in finding some positive thing here, that I'm perhaps insensitive to all the suffering that's going on, but from my own point of view, I'm optimistic that we as a church will be forced to new realizations, to new insights, to new kinds of love that we haven't had before. Thanks.
Thank you, Ken.
Who's going to go first? Carol Lynn. It's interesting, you said a moment ago that it is important for us to reach out and be able to speak to those who are homosexual back and forth. It's interesting how difficult this is for us in our culture. Carol Lynn and Gerald were very close friends of ours when we were going to school together at BYU. And after so generously publishing his wife's book, he went on and published a book for me. And I was a very close friend to Gerald. Gerald never knew. I never knew Gerald was homosexual, and I wish that he had known that is, when I was a missionary years earlier, I baptized 2 people in 2.5 years in Denmark. One of those people was homosexual. I met him when I was there, had been there 6 months. I worked with him for 2 years. He was baptized into the church the weekend before I left to come home. Is one of my very dearest friends and has been through the years. And I saw over the years the pain and struggle that he went through as he tried to assimilate Mormon culture and society and finally had to leave that which had become very dear to him. And I wish that I could have been able to have talked with Gerald and known. Another close friend who is homosexual, there was a question here about why can't a person who doesn't find a mate and is celibate through their life, isn't it just as simple for, shouldn't the homosexual take the same perspective? In many intimate talks, in trying to understand my other friend's homosexuality, he said one thing at one time that really struck me very strongly, and that was that when you walk down the street and you see a woman and you get a sexual feeling, he said, I go down the street and I see a man, and before I realize, before my conscious mind can tell me that what my unconscious mind has felt, my conscious mind has hated me and rejected me within the very heart of my being because of my religious beliefs. And that is a much more difficult problem. And that it touches on the kinds of problems that the homosexual individual has to deal with, and it is important for us to become empathetic to those feelings.
Indeed. Thank you, Dennis.
Carolyn, I want to personally express my appreciation for your courage and what you're doing. But I also want to express appreciation to Sunstone as an organization for having the courage to not only have this particular session, but also the session that we had earlier this afternoon. And I encourage everyone who was not there to at least get a copy of the tape. Because if you want to learn more, that tape will help. And let me just say, if anybody has felt the Spirit of the Lord here, as I have, the Spirit of love, the Spirit of compassion, a yearning to understand one another and to truly get closer to the goal of becoming one, then, as I, you have felt the same spirit that we feel from time to time in our fast and testimony meetings. And so I just want to say thank you for being sensitive enough, because I know that one way or another, the Lord is going to get the Latter-day Saints to become a Zion people. And if it doesn't happen through programs, it will happen through the church itself. We here are the church. The church is the people. We're feeling love here tonight for people that we don't understand, some of us. And that's what it's all about. And I pray that all of us can have the courage after tonight to follow through on the feelings that we're having tonight.
Carolyn, my best friend as a boy, in later years, as I would visit him in New York, go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art with my wife, and receive the best instruction in 15th and 16th century French furniture, I came to sense needs. I came to know that he was a homosexual. He would offer his apartment and to my wife and me and move elsewhere. I once in Washington felt a real need to communicate with him, was unable to do so by phone, and wrote him a letter. His separated wife told me that he was unwilling to open that letter. And he died a few months later of AIDS, unwilling to share with me as a friend the great struggle. His boys and wife asked me to speak at the graveside services. How could I have been a better friend? Should I have not confronted him, but tried to talk with him about suspicions? I don't even want to say that. I had shared so much as a boy with him, music and art and literature, that somehow he felt embarrassed to continue that sharing. What could I have done as a friend?
That is a very tough one. I don't know that. It's hard for all of us to know when to reach out and even be a little bit pushy so that we can reach out, and when just to mind our own business. I find that a tough question all the time. I would think maybe we could err on the side of being available rather than err on the side of being distant, and maybe risk an offense if we can make that reaching out effort a very good and kind one. And I've had other people here speak to me on that question, saying, I really believe that this is what my nephew or my son or friend is experiencing, but I can't say anything to him. Now, one reason that I wrote the book is that maybe somebody could just share the book with people and open the door to conversation. But what you've asked is a very difficult thing, and I have no easy answer. Thank you.